Welcome to episode 145 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. The Sentientism worldview answers those two deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Michael Dorff. Michael is a law professor and scholar of US constitutional law. He's the Robert S. Stevens Professor of Law at Cornell Law School. In addition to constitutional law, Michael has taught courses in civil procedure and federal courts. He's written or edited three books, including No Litmus Test, Law versus Politics in the 21st Century, and Constitutional Law Stories, as well as writing scores of law review articles about American constitutional law. He's also a columnist for Verdict. Michael is a former law clerk to Justice Anthony Kennedy of the US Supreme Court and Judge Stephen Reinhardt of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Michael has appeared in American news media as a legal expert and has been interviewed by and or quoted in The New York Times, CNN, National Public Radio, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and many other places. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 144 others. Don't forget to work through our back catalogue if you've just found us. Every person who reviews and rates or shares our podcast with a friend helps us nudge more people towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for Sentientism on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Good morning.
Yeah, well, it's great to speak. Thank you so much for taking the time to join this series of sentientist conversations. I feel like I have a bit of a one-way parasocial relationship with you already because I've listened to so much of your thinking and Sherry's as well on places like Our Hen House and other podcasts. Although that's a sign of my amateur standard that I've listened to you on podcasts but haven't read enough of your formal work. But it's been great to get a sort of sense of your thinking and the contributions you make. So it's great to have the chance to have a proper conversation.
Well, thanks very much. And, I'm happy to contribute any way I can.
Yeah, great. Well, as you know already, this is a series of conversations about what I think of as the deepest and most important philosophical questions, and also the ones I think most of humanity still frustratingly gets wrong. So the first question is, what's real? At this, the epistemological question of how should we best understand the universe? How should we choose what to believe? And the second question, just as important, is that of morality, and particularly moral scope, which beings, which entities should warrant moral consideration and get our compassion. And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to develop and popularize this really simplistic, pluralistic worldview called sentientism, which suggests, in a sentence, that we should use an approach committed to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. So in a way, that's a sort of naturalistic approach to epistemology and a sentiocentric scope, at least when it comes to our moral scope and compassion. But I'm talking to people in this series of conversations, regardless of whether they agree or disagree with different aspects of that. So it'll be fascinating to understand your own philosophical journey and how that fits into what you do now. But before sure. We get on to those big questions, how would you best introduce yourself and your work?
So my name is Michael Dorff. My friends call me Mike. My dearest friends and loved ones call me Michael. I'm not sure why. My official title is I am the Robert S. Stevens Professor of Law at Cornell Law School in Ithaca, New York. By training, I'm a lawyer. I studied physics as an undergraduate. I did a year of graduate school in physics, but that was sort of just as a lark so I could spend a year in New Zealand because that's what they allowed me to put down on the form in order to be able to, go hiking and traipsing around. Then I went to law school, clerked for a couple of judges, and I've been a legal scholar ever since. Most of my work is in U.S. constitutional law. But I've also thought and written quite a bit about a lot of other subjects, some of it in my scholarship, but also because I write biweekly columns for a website called Verdict, which is justia.verdict.com or verdict.justia.com, I don't remember which. And I publish a blog since 2006, the column since 2000, and just the need to generate, two, three, sometimes four pieces a week, you run out of material if you just focus on U.S. constitutional law, even though the US and much of the rest of the world is constantly in a constitutional crisis, you still run out of material, so you branch out. I've been a vegan since 2006, which is roughly when I started the blog. And so issues of relations between non-humans and humans have, you know, been important to me since then and occasionally make their way into my work. I should say a lot of that was influenced by and in partnership with my wife, Sherry Kolb, who passed away this past August. And so I it's hard for me to think about issues of animals, animal rights, speciesism, and so forth without thinking about, you know, what are my views and what are Sherry's views. We agreed on nearly everything, but not quite everything. So I think that in some respects it's, you know, I have a distinctive view, but mostly I think these are views that would have been reflective of our joint thinking, both in works of co-authorship and just in discussion and so forth.
Yeah, thank you. So let's start with the first of those big philosophical questions, this what's real question. So for many of my guests, it's a story about whether they grew up originally in quite a sort of naturalistic, scientifically minded family and society, for example, or one that was maybe more religious or supernatural or mystical in some sense, and how that side of their thinking has changed over their life, if it has. So you can wind the clock back as far as you like to tell the story.
Sure. So I grew up in the New York City area. My parents raised my sister and me Jewish, but mostly culturally. We went to religious after school programs. I had a bar mitzvah. I can read Hebrew and understand some of it. I would say that at a few points in my childhood, I thought about maybe I had religious beliefs, but the truth is it was always much more of a cultural experience for me. And I would say a big part of that was my father's influence. So my father never went to synagogue unless, you know, it was somebody's wedding or something. And my mother would take my sister and me. But my father, who was not at all religious, he had studied philosophy as a young man. He was an actuary in his work, but he had a lot of other interests. But he wasn't at all religious. But he was the most ethical person I knew. And so I think I drew from this that, religion is not necessary and certainly, you know, from lots of other examples, not sufficient to make someone an ethical person. And that, you know, I admired my father enormously. So that sort of personal aspect of it, I think, overshadowed anything I was being taught in school, whether in my secular school or in these after-school programs.
Yeah, thank you. And did that, as you came across people who clearly did have supernatural views, whether that was formerly in education or rabbis or others in the community, what was your experience of thinking about those views? Did they just not really seem that relevant or interesting to you? Were you intrigued? Did you see something negative there? Or how did that interaction with the sort of supernatural bits of the Jewish worldview feel to you?
Yeah, I guess it never intrigued me nearly as much as what I encountered elsewhere. So my dad had a great library, which he accumulated as a undergraduate and a graduate student, and then just otherwise. And so, you know, I found that the sorts of answers that the religious folks were giving to deep philosophical questions, you know, barely scratched the surface. Whereas if I went into my dad's study, pulled down, you know, Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy, or, you know, the works of Lao Tzu or whatever, right? Those struck me as much more deeply engaged. And I think this has affected how I am as a classroom teacher as well, which is that what I really value is engagement with hard questions. And it struck me, I don't know that I would have put it this way when I was younger, but that the the sorts of answers that religion gives sort of stop asking the questions just when they become interesting, right? That is, you know, well, yeah, because God made the world, or because, you know, God thus commanded it, right? That's an answer that, you know, I suppose one could accept it, but it leaves lots of further questions unasked.
Yeah, and some find that finality sort of reassuring, because you can go about your daily life without having to deal with the scary stuff that remains unanswered. And other people find that, I guess, intellectually frustrating or curious at the very least, and want to keep digging, and I guess intuitively more comfortable, you know, not knowing and continuing to explore maybe forever rather than needing that finality. But so it sounds like that engagement, yeah, was what you valued more than wanting a clean, easy answer that you could walk away from.
Yeah, I think part of it is temperamental. I mean, I you know, I've heard religious people say that, you know, they choose to believe whatever the thing is, or they believe it as a matter of faith. And it's not that I feel like that's not possible for me, although it isn't possible, but it almost doesn't, I don't even understand the disposition. I've never been able to choose to believe things, right? I find that, well, just to give you a sort of a trivial example. So I don't fly very often, but occasionally I have to go somewhere. And Ithaca is not near anything. And so we have this little airport with, so to get anywhere, you have to take a little plane and then a bigger plane. And the little planes are, you know, bounce around and if there's substantial wind or turbulence. Now, I've read quite a bit about air travel, and I learned that turbulence is not unsafe. And yet, whenever I'm on an airplane and if there's substantial turbulence, I feel uneasy and anxious. And I tell myself, right, I try to remember, this is not a sign that the plane is about to crash. I find that doesn't help me very much, right? So that
yeah,
so that even the reassurance of an evidence-based factual statement that I know to be true is not very reassuring to me if I'm having a certain kind of reaction. And so it's very hard for me to imagine how someone could choose to believe something that isn't even true or based on evidence as a means of providing them reassurance.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. So we, in some senses, you believe based on the evidence and the reasoning, you can't see a different way even being valid. But in some contexts, you're aware that, you know, our temperament doesn't allow us to completely control our emotional reactions, and, you know, and
there's other
modes of processing that are going on that we're not, you know, completely grasping. Yeah, no, that's fascinating. Thank you. And this question of theism is obviously quite a central one when we're talking about naturalism, supernaturalism, or different ways of thinking about reality, but it's not the only space. So there are many people who might agree with me on a naturalistic view of theism that leads you to atheism or agnosticism, but still have, you know, other space for supernatural beliefs in other realms of their lives. Are there other spaces where you have some openness to the possibility of the supernatural or the spiritual or the transcendent or something else? Or are you sort of consistently, I guess, naturalistic across the board in the way you think?
I mean, the short answer is probably I'm quite naturalistic. Part of it is that nearly all of the spiritual or supernatural beliefs I've encountered, whether religious or otherwise, strike me as ridiculous. And again, I think that's partly temperamental. So when I was in college, I took a class in Indian philosophy, which was taught by a professor, a philosopher who knew nothing about Indian philosophy. It's taught by Robert Nozick, who's a great philosopher, but he was just interested. It was a sort of graduate seminar but it was open to undergraduates. And he asked Amartya Sen, what should we read? And so he came up with a reading list of sort of classical works of Indian philosophy, you know, from classical antiquity and relatively more modern. And so we encountered all sorts of things, but really the value of the class was that Nozick was such a great philosopher, and it was fun to sort of be there as he was doing philosophy. And so one of the things I remember
he was sort of thinking it through with you rather than presenting his, you know, finished view on the topics. Yeah,
exactly. And so we had a, I don't remember what the official reading was for the class, but there was a day in which we were talking about sort of, you know, mystical views. And one of the things he said was that, you know, you would think that people with mutually contradictory mystical views would be hostile to one another. And sometimes they are, right? You think about wars of religion and, you know, that's what that amounts to. But he was recounting an experience in which, you know, somebody who believes, you know, that, you know, you should sleep under a pyramid because, you know, the ancient Egyptians, whatever, that encounters somebody else who has some completely, you know, at best orthogonal set of mystical views. And they find each other interesting, and each wants to learn from the other and is sympathetic to their respective views, even though they don't logically cohere. And so I think that conversely, you know, if you begin with a sort of naturalistic worldview, then all these other ideas are going to seem bizarre and ridiculous. Now, that's not to say that there aren't unexplained phenomena, right? And, right, you know, one must always be open to the possibility that the sky will open up and a giant hand will reach down and say, you know, you've been fooled. There weren't dinosaurs. Those were bones I placed there to test your faith. And if that happens, right, I'll adjust my views. But that will be in response to evidence. So that itself, I think, would be a kind of naturalism.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, we're going to struggle to disagree on that. I'm very much in that mode. No, it's good. It's good. I mean, it won't make the YouTube gods happy that we're failing to destroy each other and so on. But yeah, no, I completely agree. And I sometimes draw a slight distinction between sort of ontological naturalism that is just the view that reality is exhausted by the natural world. I happen to, you know, ascribe to that with pretty high probability too. But for me, almost what's more important is the methodological, the epistemological side, which says, you know, I might be open-minded about the possibility of supernatural stuff, but I'm not going to believe in anything until there's, you know, reasonable evidence to support that view. And that method to me seems more important ultimately than your conclusion about the ontology. Although it is interesting that, as you hinted at earlier on, many people with a religious or a supernatural worldview will say, you know, my view doesn't need evidence and reasoning. It's purely faith. It's a fideistic view. But many will actually say, well, no, Jamie, I'm with you and Mike. You know, I'm committed to evidence and reason as well. And I've read the Bible and I've had a personal experience. And, you know, so I think I'm following a completely naturalistic approach to my belief in a deity or angels or the existence of heaven and hell. But I guess at least with that, you have the chance to have a constructive conversation because you can then challenge the evidence and have a process of reasoning. Whereas if someone has taken a deliberately fideistic approach, it's hard to really engage with that in any meaningful way because almost by definition, it's immune to any evidence. But
yeah, I will say that, I mean, the core reason in evidence for me against the existence of, you know, benevolent deity is, right, the existence of evil in the world. And that, you know, I find myself sometimes Sherry's parents were Holocaust survivors, and all of her other relatives, whom she never met, were wiped out by the Nazis. And there are all sorts of evils going on in the world today, and many of them generated by humans, some generated by pathogens, all sorts of other things. And so I actually find myself offended when, you know, after winning a football game or something, you see an athlete, you know, thanking God. And I, you know, right, it strikes me as arrogant to think that, right, the creator of the universe thought to intervene in the otherwise orderly progression of events to ensure that the ball bounced this way rather than that, but not to prevent the suffering and death of, you know, millions of humans and billions of non-human animals. And so to right. So I might the on at least on the evidence with respect to the moral state of the world, I might be amenable to the belief that the world was created by a malevolent being, but that's not really on offer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's not an option that many people put forward. And I'd agree, right? And it's I know many politicians must be deeply jealous of this status that deities have managed to attain, where you get thanked and praised for all the good stuff, but you're completely Teflon when it comes to any of the bad stuff. Yeah. So the earthquake happens, 10,000 people die, one person survives, and that's a miracle. But no one thinks of the 9,999 other people that were killed for no reason by apparently a benevolent deity. And as you've also hinted at, one of the responses to this problem of evil is to ultimately blame, you know, us flawed humans, because you know, Eve turned us away from the Garden of Eden, and you know, our own free will has been misused, and all of the bad in the world is because of human free will. But when you start, you know, again thinking about pathogens or natural disasters, or particularly problems of wild animal suffering, some of which is caused by humans, but most of which absolutely isn't. Again, you know, I just don't see how the omnipotent, omniscient, benevolent triumvirate can hold together. But
I believe the technical term for this argument is theodicy, and I think it's flawed even in its own terms. I said that even putting aside non-human made suffering, right? Presumably the God that created the universe also chose to give us free will and to create us in such ways that we would have desires and plans that then lead to these terrible things, right? So, I find free will to be an intriguing concept, but again, assuming that there is some kind of free will, it's not absolutely free, right? You can't will yourself to travel faster than the speed of light or to shoot lasers out of your eyes. So there are limits to what we can do with our free will. And again, if you're inclined to believe that this is all part of some divine design, then presumably the creator is responsible for the particular configuration of the limit on the free will.
Yeah, and presumably knew how all of that would play out.
Right, so, right.
Yeah, agree. So again, we're going to struggle to disagree, but I do find this space fascinating because most people on the planet, I think it's fair to say, you know, would disagree with this, right? And do have this sense of some sort of all-powerful deity. But one of the things I'm interested in, both as we talk about ethics and this sort of naturalistic question, is what people's experiences are like socially as their minds change. So in this series of conversations, I've spoken to some people who are still religious, but most of the people I've spoken to have moved away from a religious or a supernatural worldview that they grew up in and are now in some way, shape or form broadly naturalistic like you and me. And for some people, that journey was reasonably easy because the supernatural didn't really play a core part of their thinking as they were young. Yes, it might have been important in their society, but it wasn't really central. It's just something that drifted away and they moved on. At the other extreme are people who that turning away from a supernatural worldview and the religion associated with it was deeply scarring, extremely difficult, and in some cases even physically risky given the society they lived in and the behavior of their family and friends as well. So there's a massive scale of, you know, almost trivial to really, really hard journeys away from the supernatural worldview. Did you ever feel friction or challenge as you sort of thought these things through, or where was it on that scale?
Yeah, I think I'm very much in the first camp, right? That is to say, I grew up around but not strongly inculcated in a religious or supernatural view. I mean, I have changed my mind about things that are extremely important to me, but that's not one of them.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And the impression I get is, I think from the, you know, things like the Pew Research Survey, and when you look at international surveys as well, the prevalence of people who have naturalistic ways of thinking is actually quite high, even within religiously identified communities. So I think that's quite common. In some cases, it's not safe to be open about that, but you might disclose it in a confidential survey. But my impression of Jewish communities in general is that, for the most part, there are many, many people who don't have supernatural views in those sort of communities, and it's treated as quite an ordinary, safe, accepted thing to do, partly because there seems to be a really rich culture of questioning and challenge and, you know, robust debate. Is that a sort of fair view?
Yes. I mean, I would add two bits of nuance. So one is that, you know, there really are two distinct Jewish communities. Basically, since Napoleon, a set of sort of what we think of as liberal Jews, right? People who have a cultural attachment of varying strength, may or may not practice the religion to one degree or another, but are essentially modern people that, you know, similar to people raised nominally Christian in most of the developed world.
Yeah, and ethnically then, Jewish, but maybe the religious stuff is less central,
Right, and so that's the group in which I fall. But then there is a different and growing, because of birth rates, set of people who are, you know, essentially fundamentalist, right? The Hebrew word is Haredi, sometimes called ultra-Orthodox. It's a, you know, mostly descendants of survivors of the Holocaust from Eastern Europe. And I think their worldview is, you know, profoundly religious. But I will say, from what I understand, even within that community, practice is more important than faith, right? So that, you know, you probably couldn't become a leading rabbi in one of these ultra-Orthodox communities by publicly challenging the whatever the theological view is. But it's much less important than sort of knowledge of the texts and traditions and so forth and practicing of the rituals. And just on the questioning, right? So there's this famous story, which I think is true, but I don't know. It's been fictionalized a bunch of times. And so it takes place in one of the death camps, or maybe it was at Auschwitz, that there's this group of all very religious men, and they put God on trial, and they have a you know, because like what's going on, and they have a trial, and they essentially convict God, and then when they're done, they pray, and so that I think so even within sort of Orthodox Judaism, there is, as you say, this sort of tradition of questioning, but it's always bracketed by, but you have to do the stuff anyway.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you.
Sure.
So we've answered that first question of what's real, or if not what's real, at least how should we go about trying to work it out, hopefully with some humility. I think we both share that broadly naturalistic approach. The second question, which you've hinted at already, is what matters? I guess the questions of ethics, and then we'll come on to who matters. And for many people, these two questions are tied together, partly because if you grow up in a religious context, often they are bundled together. You know, here's the stuff you need to believe or you're supposed to believe, and here's also the list of, you know, guidance, ethics, principles, rules that you should follow in practice. So for some people who've moved away from a religious worldview, that becomes another level of challenge, because they almost feel like they have to rebuild their ethics in some, you know, other way. And you've already hinted that that probably wasn't a difficult issue for you, because you had the role model of your father, a deeply ethical man who was, in a sense, you know, naturalistic in his way of thinking. So you never felt that connection. But one, I'm interested in whether there was ever any tension as you thought through, you know, the basics of your ethics as you started to read and learn about philosophy, and two, what is the story of how you've come to think about the foundations of ethics and morality, if such things exist?
Sure. So I think that in my actual living of my life, I am deeply pragmatic, in the sense that, you know, someone like William James or John Dewey would have used the term pragmatism, right? That is, I think that, so my moral intuitions come before any attempt at synthesizing or deriving them from some more overarching schema. And I think I get that from my father as well. So I'll just tell a story and then I'll move on to sort of, you know, where, how I locate that. So when I was born at the particular hospital where I was born, there happened to be a group of child psychologists conducting what turned out to be a decades-long longitudinal study of parents and children. And they asked my parents if they wanted to participate. And I guess, you know, this was the 60s, so they said, sure. And what that meant was that a researcher would come to my parents' apartment, I think, two or three times during my first couple of years of life, interview my father. They did follow-up studies every few years. And eventually, one batch of the research was published as a book. And so there's a chapter on my father and me. Wow. Makes references to my mother and my sister. We are disguised with a pseudonym. There are 20 chapters in the book. The book is called Mothers, Fathers, and Children. And so there are 10 on mothers and 10 on fathers and their respective children. And so it describes a whole bunch of interesting things, including some things that are, of course, terribly embarrassing as an adult. But
is that your first citation?
Yeah,
I'm not sure that quite counts.
But not under my name. There's reports of what my father told the interviewers. And one of the things he said that struck me for many years was, he said, they asked him what his philosophy of child rearing was, and he said, I'm anti-philosophical. Now, this was deeply ironic from someone who studied philosophy as an undergraduate, was a graduate student in philosophy, read philosophy for pleasure. And what I took that to mean was that he was against a kind of top-down philosophy. He believed strongly in sort of following his instincts, seeing where, you know, what was working, what wasn't working. Again, you have to say, well, what does it mean to say something's working? But you sort of had a bunch of operating principles and everything flowed from that. So I think in my life, I have largely followed that model. And part of pragmatism is you do it almost unthinkingly, right? That is, it's not as though I set out to do that. That's just sort of reflecting back on how I am. I think that's the case. Having said that, though, I am, there are some things I'm very deliberate about. So, you know, when I became a vegan, that meant, you know, making choices and doing it on a daily basis. We can talk about how I came to that, but I want to say that the way that, you know, I've then sort of reflected back on this is, I would say that when I think about issues of ethics and normativity more broadly, my methodology is, broadly speaking, coherentist, or, you know, aiming at what Rawls called reflective equilibrium. And that leads me to a view that I think is closer to deontology than utilitarianism, but it's not important to me to have, you know, to locate exactly where it fits within existing, you know, modes of philosophy.
Yeah, thank you. So it sounds like you start with your intuitions, but you're comfortable interrogating those, checking they're coherent, working on them, and being quite serious about how to try and put them into practice. But the starting point is the intuition. And I guess one of the – I'm quite comfortable with that approach myself. I'm not a philosopher, and I've also spoken to Professor Mike Hoomer, who's talked a lot about intuitionism, both in epistemology and in ethics as well. I think he'd be very sympathetic to what you've just said. One obvious challenge is, well, that's great if you have good, you know, compassionate, caring intuitions, but what if someone has an intuition that is much more might means right? And, how do we cope with the fact that we might see each other's intuitions as being less valid or less constructive?
Yeah. So So this is referred to in the literature as the problem of bad coherence, right? That is, you can get a worldview that coheres, but it coheres in ways that cause external harm. I guess what I would say is I would distinguish the social question from the individual question, right? So that if somebody has bad intuitions, whether because they were born that way or some experience they had growing up or whatever it is, they have intuitions that make them selfish, they're abusive, etc., right? It's not that any philosophical argument, whether rooted in their own intuitions or in some form of authority, is going to be effective in making them act less antisocially, right? So that if you're appealing to somebody, right, your appeal will run out if someone doesn't want to be appealed to. But there is a separate question about what the rest of us should do about that. So yeah. Oliver Wendell Holmes had this idea said that's the role for law. He had what he called the bad man theory of the law, right? And he says that we should look at the law from the you want to look at the law from the perspective of a bad man. The bad man has no natural tendency to want to do good or to avoid harming, and so law for the bad man is a means of the rest of us exercising social control over him to rein him in. And so I do think that with respect to people who start with bad intuitions, right, it might be possible to persuade them. Maybe they have bad intuitions because, you know, they just haven't thought things through clearly enough. But if they're just, you know, bad actors, then that to me is a question of what society does about that more than it is about how we go about persuading them.
Yeah, that makes sense. It makes sense. And one of the risks I sometimes see in a reliance on intuition is that sometimes it can link to maybe a, you know, naively optimistic view of human nature, in that, of course, we do have enormous capacity for compassion and cooperation and to work together and to have common cause, but we also have quite a lot of, you know, outgroup aggression and, you know, proclivity for violence and so on as well. Yeah. So there's, I guess that's partly where that risk can come in.
Right.
I mean, there's good and bad in human nature, and therefore good and bad in human intuitions as well, arguably.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And so I want to be clear, I'm not an intuitionist in the sense that I don't think it's intuitions all the way down. I am willing to let go of those of my intuitions that I think are not justified in, you know, my reason. But I do think that you need to start someplace. And you really only have two options. One is to start by positing some very, very general principles that you think are a priori true, and then derive practical lessons from them. I think that's very hard to figure out why they're a priori true, especially if they're moral intuitions. Then there's a question of, you know, the metaethics of what the nature of moral compositions is, right? Or you start from the bottom up. And, you know, I think that even if people, even when people exhibit behaviors that are deeply antisocial, they will usually try to justify them in other regarding terms that suggest that it's not that they lack the moral intuitions, it's that they don't feel bound to act on them.
Yeah, yeah, agree. And it sort of links almost to the epistemology question we were talking about before, because if someone's completely fideistic, it's difficult to engage using a naturalistic basis. And in this, in an ethical sense, it's sort of similar in that if someone says, look, I just like being evil and that's it, and I don't believe morality exists, you're going to struggle to have a moral discussion with them that's going to be productive, and you then fall back to, okay, well, what do the rest of us do about it? Yeah, and it seems that I think for most people, it ends up being a fairly pragmatic interplay between those things. So, you know, you might start with a set of intuitions, and then you challenge those philosophically, but also you do thinking, and you think about coherence and consistency and so on. And but you also test that thinking against your intuitions, because if it bumps up against it, you know, are you biting a bullet? Or so I think in practical terms, most people end up with an interplay between a sort of intuitions and sort of more formal ways of thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can't speak for most people, but certainly that's true of me.
Yeah, yeah. So if could you, based on where your intuitions are and the thinking you've done since, if someone said to you, what do good and bad, right and wrong actually mean to you? What's at the root of how you think about this stuff? There a way of describing what that is and what's the basis?
Yeah, so I think we're not going to disagree much here either. So I would say it's actually easier for me to describe bad than it is to describe good, right? That is, bad is acting in ways that harm others, I guess include oneself. Now, what does it mean to harm, right? Cause a setback to their interests, frustrate their plans, you know, injure, kill, et cetera, right? And so, you know, it's a little like the Hippocratic Oath, right? So first, do no harm. And so that seems to me to be the core of ethics, right? Which is that one oughtn't to do things that are going to cause harm. Recognizing that there's lots of room for elaboration and disagreement about what constitutes harm. And then secondarily, right, try to do some good. It's funny, I was just working on a blog post that I'll run either Thursday or Friday of this week about Sam Bankman-Fried, you know, who was before his fall from grace and implosion and apparently indictment, was sort of the public face of a particular version of effective altruism, right? This idea that you should earn a lot of money and then give it away.
Or more broadly, at least, just try to do the most good you can.
Right. What I'm addressing in the blog post is, you know, to what extent, if any, does his experience undercut the case for effective altruism? And I think it doesn't at all undercut the case for the broad concept that one ought to try to do as much good as one can. But I do think that it sheds some light on this particular version of it that says you should, you know, earn a lot of money to, you know, make as much money as you can to give it away. I had occasion to take a look at again at Peter Singer's book, you know, the most good you can do. I forgot, is that the exact title? Something, I think it's called The Most Good You Can Do. It's a title like that. It's a 2016 book. And he has a chapter on this particular version of it. So I had occasion to sort of refer to that. I guess I feel like it would be great if there are people who do the most good that they can do. I feel like I'm not capable of that. I feel like my job is to do, you know, the most good I can do consistent with leading my life in a way that I find fulfilling. Because, right, you know, given the diminishing marginal utility of money, it is almost certainly the case that I could live on a lot less than I consume, give it away, and that would do better. Now maybe this is just rationalization. While that would be great, right? That I'm not under a moral obligation to do that, but I, you know, I want to come closer to doing that than I currently live. So it's a kind of shadow of Singer's idea. And I should say, I mean, I know Peter Singer a little bit. I think very highly of him. I'm not a utilitarian, but I've learned a lot from his work. You know, I think that that's how he lives as well. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't live a subsistence lifestyle. I think he doesn't think it's, you know, morally obligatory that he do so. I guess the way I would put it, and again, this might be rationalization, is that should implies can. A set of moral beliefs that imposes obligations that are inconsistent with human nature for most people is, you know, not realistic.
Yeah, that makes sense. I look forward to reading it. And I think it struck me that in that particular case, there's a couple of other things going on there. One is the danger of a sort of maximizing ethos. Because if you're totally focused on achieving one particular outcome and you're willing to take enormous risks to maximize that outcome, and it turns out that you're a bit wrong about that outcome, or there are some problems caused on the way by your maximizing, things can go wrong. And we need a much healthier dose of moral and epistemological uncertainty as we work out what to do. And again, that might just be a rationalization for why you know, you and I shouldn't maximize our contribution to the good of the world. But it also strikes me that in many fields, we're very familiar with this ends and means problem where, you know, a nation state or an all-powerful leader or a deity or some other cause can lead to terrible horrors in the pursuit of some ultimate end goal that is supposed to justify almost anything. And I think the irony is that you could actually imagine that happening even in an altruistic context, where if achieving the maximum possible good is such an overridingly strong aim, you know, what harms are you willing to cause in its pursuit? And I just a heavy dose of humility, I think, is required whenever we're going down those sort of paths. I'm much more favorable about approaches that are, you know, robustly positive than I am about things that are maximally positive, because those risks seem, you know, I think SBF is probably a great case study on both fronts.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So, and this is partly why, you know, we'll come on to this next question about who matters next. Part of the reason I've tried to frame sentientism in a very, very broad pluralistic sense ethically is, one, I think it makes sense to have a broad church. So it doesn't really matter if you take a deontological approach or a utilitarian approach or a feminist care ethic approach or a relational approach or a virtue ethics approach, as long as your ethical system includes all sentient beings in moral scope and therefore grants compassion or moral consideration to them. So it's neutral on ethical system, if you like, and all the details. It doesn't tell us how to solve all of these complex trade-offs, but it just says, look, at least get the inclusion right so that we put our arms around every sentient being. And I also try and translate that into a practical stance that, again, stays quite neutral on this sort of degree of demandingness about how much good we should be doing, and just says that surely on a basic definition of moral consideration or compassion, that should at least mean we wouldn't needlessly harm or kill, as you said, right? So I'm not going to try and solve all of ethics or work out these difficult problems, but at least get the basics right of who doesn't get excluded, who gets included, and once you're included, right, there should at least be that minimal level of protection we wouldn't needlessly harm or kill. So I quite like that framing, because I think that setting the boundary is super important. Setting that baseline of at least don't needlessly harm or kill is super important. But in a way, it's also a bit of a cop-out, because there are so many, it's avoiding so many of the difficult and fascinating ethical problems. But I still think that's the most important foundation. But I think many people would come with us on the journey you've described, where you know, ultimately what you're talking about is assessing good and bad and right and wrong, really about as something that's to do with how we value the experiences, the interests, the lives of others and the impact we have on those. So even though you might take a deontological approach, at its root, there's something there about, you know, how others' lives and experiences are going and what's our impact on that. And I think many people would agree with us, but most people on the planet would still only extend that compassion to humans and probably some selective non-human animals too. So as we move from this sort of what matters question to who matters, what was your journey there in thinking about your moral scope and particularly that critical question of, you know, non-human animals, why they should matter and what that means for you practically?
Right. So I think I certainly didn't grow up in a vegetarian or vegetarian friendly family or community. I came to it relatively late in life. So I was born in 1964. So I didn't become fully vegan until 2006. So I was already in my 40s. I mean Sherry and I, and then we also imposed this on our children, who were very young at the time. moved towards this over the course of a few years. I would strongly emphasize the social and the individual connections in this. So I don't know if viewers can see my dogs in the background. So we adopted a couple of dogs early in our marriage, and they were very important to us. And then in the summer of 1996, we spent a few weeks in the Netherlands where I was teaching, and our daily bike ride took us past a farm that had goats. And both Sherry and I were sort of city kids, so we didn't really have much experience with goats, but they were extremely friendly and, you know, sweet and playful. We would stop and they would, goats would come running to the fence. We'd scratch them and whatever. And so we came to see the similar to dogs. And so we sort of at that moment gave up eating mammals. And that, I think, opened us up to persuasion. So one of Sherry's colleagues at the time was Gary Francione, who is, of course, an important figure in the animal rights movement. And he was already vegan and sort of evangelizing for that. And so once we had, I think our journey reflects what a lot of people do. We gave up eating mammals, then birds, then fish, and then eventually dairy and eggs, and all animal products. But Gary was an influence in that, and a bit of a mentor, but more of just a sort of presence to realize, oh, this is possible. Once we became vegan, it was, again, it's sort of in the pragmatic bottom up way, right? The identification with particular animals preceded the development of a whole philosophy, or the, you know, deciding to join a philosophy. But when we moved to Ithaca, not all that long after we became vegan. So we became vegan in sort of late 2006. We moved here in the middle of 2008. And then we discovered this whole community. And I think that was crucial in maintaining and deepening our commitment to it. And we started going to these conferences and met lots of other people. And so I think there is a very strong, for me at least, social component to my veganism. And, you know, and the social component includes non-human animals like my dogs, but also people who share the beliefs and practices. I'm not sure if that was fully responsive to your question, which I've forgotten now.
No, that's great. It's good. Follow up. No, it's good. It really was about that sort of journey to thinking seriously about non-human animals and how that played out. Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you. And again, I'm really fascinated at the social context for people making this journey. And often it seems like it has parallels with the move away from a religion sometimes, mm-hmm. in that often the individual becomes quite convinced that this is the right path to go down, but their family and society often doesn't agree and pushes back. So how did that feel for you? Because for some of my guests, it's very much a sort of teenage thing. You know, there's a 12-year-old who sits down at the dinner table and says, I care about animals, so I'm not going to eat them anymore. And you have that challenge of family and friends and parents, you know, worrying and pressuring. But for, you know, a fully grown man as a highly respected professional and academic and lawyer, what did it feel like going through that transition? You talked about the sort of positive side of the social network you had and the support and the role models and the connections, but did you feel a challenge from friends, family, colleagues, society in making that shift?
Yes. Yeah, sure. I think various friends and relatives were more or less accommodating. I don't think nobody I knew socially insisted that I, you know, eat the animal product. The bigger challenge, I think, is having it taken seriously as a moral commitment, right? So that is, yeah, it doesn't happen to me much anymore, because I think veganism is much more, I'm going to say popular, but there are more vegans now than there were 16 years ago when I made this transition. Some people are more familiar with it. They're less likely to challenge it. They think of it partly, some of them are doing it for health reasons, so they think that makes sense. But, you know, people would, it would often occasion an interrogation, which was somewhat unpleasant. I had, you know, friends who were sort of mentors as vegans who'd been doing it longer, who would, you know, say, well, this is an opportunity to persuade someone, you know, keep your cool, try to be open-minded. And, you know, I tried to do that. But I do remember that, yeah, for the first, I don't know, half dozen years I was a vegan, that I would have more of those difficult conversations. You know, the title of one of Sherry's solo books is Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger, which is very much about this social question, right? Because you sit down at a meal with someone who's not a vegan and they think you're judging them. And of course you are. You're judging their actions. You might not be judging their character, but you are judging their actions. How could you not, right? To have a moral commitment is to think that something is a moral obligation. And it's, unless you're a narcissist, if it's a moral obligation for me, it's a moral obligation for others, and they're in violation of it. So of course you're judging their actions, and they, I think, correctly perceive that. And they, because they're not at that moment anyway, willing to examine their own choices, they have a kind of reactive set of defense mechanisms which show up as hostility. And so that is a real phenomenon. I'm certainly wasn't immune to that. I will say that I encounter it much less these days than I used to. So it's much more common now that if I, you know, go out to lunch with a non-vegan, they'll order vegan for me even without my asking them to. You know, that won't happen if it's a group of 12, but if it's, you know, just me and somebody else, yes.
Yeah, it's normalizing, isn't it? We're getting there slowly. And I do find it fascinating because, as you've said, that's one of my deep frustrations is I don't want it just to be accepted as the thing I'm doing. I want it to be acknowledged as an ethical stance, even a social justice cause. Yep. And in the same way as, you know, no one would sit down next to you in a restaurant and say, do you mind if I be homophobic?
Right.
I mean, the same person would never say that, right? But it does strike me that there is an evolutionary stage. You know, there's the pushback and the denial and the rejection and the somewhat aggressive challenge. And then there's this sort of grudging acceptance where people, and I think this is probably where many of the people I know in real life today are, which is they think it's almost some sort of weird sort of optional hobby, like a dietary preference that I've chosen to do, right, that they will, you know, they will accommodate, you know, if I go to dinner at their house, they will make a vegan option for me. But that's sort of it. Like, they don't recognize it as a social justice cause in the same way as any of the other long lists of social justice causes that they would enthusiastically sign up for. And that, I do find that a particular frustration. It's, I guess it's just a matter of time, hopefully, as things start to shift. But
yes. Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. Yeah.
So if we, there's obviously a very strong overlap between this sort of sentiocentric way of thinking and a vegan imperative. I think they're tied pretty tightly together. Do you think of sentience as being a useful concept for, you know, setting the boundaries of moral inclusion, that sort of capacity to experience suffering and flourishing? Or do you prefer a different concept? And I guess part of the reason I'm asking that is that one obvious challenge to a sentiocentric approach and a vegan approach is to say, look, no, only humans matter. Let's go back to the anthropocentric. But there is another challenge, which is saying, look, sentientism isn't going far enough, right? What about biocentrism, ecocentrism? You know, shouldn't we care about the stuff that maybe is living but not sentient, or maybe even the things that aren't living and aren't sentient? Don't they matter too? How do you think about that sort of extent of our compassion and moral scope?
Yeah, so it's not important to me to push back strongly against these sort of, you know, the views that nature itself or inanimate objects like rivers and planets and so forth have moral interests, except for one thing, right, which is that if it's true that one ought to, you know, have moral concern for, you know, cabbage and rocks to the same extent as for a pig or a hen, right? Then it leads to a kind of quietism, and it doesn't matter. You can do anything you want.
Right? Everything matters, so nothing matters. It sort of flattens.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right. So it's a little bit like voting rights, right? That is to say, if you extend the franchise to more people, that dilutes the vote of the people who had the franchise. Now, sometimes you do that because that's what's required by notions of equality. But it is true that you're diminishing, right? There's a kind of zero-sum nature of it. I think that's true with respect to moral consideration at some point. I think sentience is a baseline for moral consideration. Now, that's not to say there aren't other very good reasons to sort of act as if ecosystems had moral interests, right? For one thing, for the benefit of the animals who live in those ecosystems, the humans and other animals who benefit from the positive externalities that rainforests and so forth produce. And there can be other values besides the values that are the sort of moral values served by a principle of non-harm, right? So I think about something like preservation of world historic archaeological sites, right? So, when the Taliban destroyed the Bamiyan Buddhas, right? That didn't, those statues didn't experience a harm, but it was a great harm to, Buddhists and everybody else in the world who could have valued them for their, aesthetic and other qualities. So now, of course, that's still a derivative value. It's not saying that the Bamiyan Buddhas are valuable in themselves. They're right. Assuming that trees aren't sentient, and I realize there are people who make certain claims about plant life, and I don't know enough to fully contest those, although I'm skeptical. But right, assuming that a tree isn't sentient, does the tree have its own interests? Well, I can understand the argument. It doesn't move me very much, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I think, again, we're with each other. I'd share that sort of really rich ecocentric concern instrumentally because of the impact on all the sentient beings, but and I do have to guard against this because I do have this sort of obsessive tendency to draw everything back to sentience, but in a way it feels inescapable in a way. So the destruction of the statues is a bad thing ultimately because of the negative impact on the sentient experiences of the people for whom those things had religious significance and aesthetic significance, and sort of it almost comes back to the momentary experience of sentient beings as the root of almost all value. But I'm quite comfortable if people want to build in different values and factors. And I think that sort of almost nth order interdependency of all things, sentient and not, we should have a rich, humble appreciation for. But I think I agree with your stance in that, if people want to go beyond sentient beings, I don't mind that, as long as they don't exclude any of the sentient beings from moral consideration. And if we are going to go beyond, then surely you have to recognize that sentience and the capacity to suffer should still bump you up the priority list so that we can see a clear distinction between cutting a pig and cutting a blade of grass. Even if you think that a blade of grass has some intrinsic moral value. So I think with those caveats, I don't mind if people, I'm much more concerned about exclusion of sentience than I am about inclusion of non-sentient beings, but.
Yeah, so I agree with that. I do think there are hard questions at the sort of boundary. So here's one that was posed to me by a friend and mentor of mine who is, I would describe as sort of vegan adjacent or vegan aspiring, but recognizes he's not going to get there. He posed this question a few years ago when I think he wasn't as close along, at least philosophically, to my position. And I think it's a hard question, right? So he says, suppose that in order to, rescue or you can construct the hypothetical. So it's avoid the destruction, the affirmative harm, killing of, you know, some insects or like a, you know, a colony of cockroaches or whatever. It's necessary to, you know, just a great art museum, including the art, the objects within it. Surely the aesthetic value, right, would mean that you can do that even though you're causing this harm. And, you know, I don't really have a good answer to that other than, you know, well, let's worry about that when we get to that question.
In the meantime, let's end all animal farming, right? Let's deal with the easy case, and then we can come on to the... But, and I agree, and in a way, this is part of the thing that, you know, sentientism, because it's so broad and pluralistic, cops out from many of those difficult things, because having moral consideration or compassion for a being doesn't mean it can never be justifiably harmed or killed. You know, there are many, whether it's theoretical trolley problems or real world problems, where it may actually be the right thing to do to harm or kill another, you know, human or otherwise.
Yeah.
But I guess the stance I'm trying to put forward is to say, but at least we need to give serious moral consideration and have compassion for every entity that's likely to be involved. So in that situation, you know, we would be thinking about the impact on the aesthetic appreciation of all the millions of humans that might enjoy the museum. But we also need to take seriously the, you know, the potential and maybe even the degree of sentience of the termites that are impacted. And I'm not suggesting there's an easy answer. Sometimes there just aren't. But at least we need to make sure that the moral consideration includes all sentient beings. And it's also neutral on this idea of whether it's a binary thing. So some people will push for a much more egalitarian version of sentientism, where they'll say, look, if you're sentient, you're in, and you should have equal consideration with every other sentient. And I think there are many obvious, you know, thought experiments that might test that stance in practice, whereas many other sentientists say, well, I agree all sentient beings should be included, but maybe there are degrees of sentience or different dimensions of sentience, and there might be different moral weightings we might reasonably apply within that scope. But again, I'm sort of copping out of the difficult questions and focusing on the baseline.
So that is the one issue on which Sherry and I actually actively disagreed.
Really?
And so she was much more in the egalitarian camp, and I was in of the view that I want to leave room for the possibility that, you know, if push comes to shove, you prefer the gorilla over the sparrow or whatever it is, right? And you know, we wrote around our disagreement on that to, you know, basically say that, you know, the my view, which we didn't identify specifically as my view, but that my view was sufficient to get you where people ought to be going, even though maybe this other view could be in principle correct.
Yeah. And I think I'm probably more, you know, personally more on your side of the argument than I am on Sherry's. There are some traps there, right? Because one of the things us humans are great at is reinventing some new construct or way of thinking or hierarchy that conveniently puts us at the top. So if we then come back to saying humans are at some peak level of sentience and everything else is sort of scattered beneath us, you can go back into some quite dangerous places. But I think at the same time, I still think it might be justifiable, and we need to have the humility to recognize humans might not be at the top of that scale. It's probably not even a scale, right? It's probably multidimensional. And we can see that as we understand more about non-human capacities in their evolutionary history too. And there's some interesting views. One is, you know, we seem to have very advanced cognitive capabilities, so presumably that makes our sentience, positive and negative, much richer than maybe some simpler animals. But there's a counter view, which is, you know, if you have less of a cognitive ability to reason to drive your actions, maybe the imperative of experience, sentience, needs to be even stronger if you're a simpler animal, because you don't have the same cognitive capability. And of course, us humans have abilities to mitigate suffering in many situations, whereas other non-humans may not. You know, one of my previous guests talked about the thought experiment of, imagine a chimp going to the dentist, right? We might suffer exactly the same physical experience, but you know, I would understand why I'm there and the benefit to me, and I will know it will end, and chimp may not. So I think with the right level of humility in that, watching out for the anthropocentrism trap, I think it does make sense to think of sentience as a really rich multidimensional thing that we might value in different ways. But part of the reason I do take that view is because I'm not sure there's a really clear boundary we can draw. I think there are meaningful boundaries we can draw, but I'm not sure they're crystal clear. And for some of the people I've spoken to, they agree because they have a sort of panpsychist philosophy of mind, where they think that in a way there is a continuity from the consciousness you and I are feeling all the way down to maybe some minimal micro consciousness that even a photon has. So, you know, they see that as a continuum. I have a much more materialistic physicalist view of consciousness that basically thinks this is just an evolved class of information processing that's going on in our heads. But in a sense, there's nothing magically different from what's going on in our heads from what's going on in vanishingly simple, even non-living physical matter either. So there's that sense of, okay, if there isn't a clear boundary, you know, it makes sense to have a rich naturalistic appreciation for, you know, a range of possible sentient experiences and maybe openness to valuing those in different ways. But
yeah, so it prompts a whole sort of flood of thoughts to me that one thing that this seems to me similar to, in some ways, is the sort of philosophical question about personal identity, right? Mm. Or which, you know, is in many ways the same thing as the question about, well, you could think about it with respect to physical objects, right? So is the ship of Theseus the same ship when you replaced all the planks? And there, that seems like a stipulative, almost semantic question. But, you know, the sorts of thought experiments that, you know, people came up with, I think about the work of, you know, so Dennett, who's hostile to animals, most of these characters are Michael Perry, John Perry. A lot of these people, they come up with these elaborate thought experiments, right, where you transfer your consciousness, we duplicate you. You don't even need to think about that, right? Just think about people's brain cells being replaced over time. And this is a question, you know,
I think
Parfit wrote about this a whole lot, right? And Nozick had this idea of the closest continuer, which I found very unsatisfying. And, you know, I think what we have, at least, you know, before dementia takes hold of somebody's mind, I think we have a strong internal subjective sense of our own continuity over time to a point, but we don't really understand its boundaries. And I think sentience probably works somewhat the same way. That is, we are quite aware of our own sentience, right? You know, on sort of Cartesian, cogito ergo sum grounds. And, you know, principle of sort of, you know, simplicity suggests that animals that behave in many ways like us and similar emotions, similar brain structures have the same thing. But when you get to a very different structures, more, you know, quote, primitive life forms, you know, we're just not sure where that goes. Yeah,
I agree. And I still think there's, you know, a meaningful difference there. I'm not falling into this flattening idea because, you know, some of the science I find most compelling is Ginsberg and Jablonka have done work around unlimited associative learning, where they're talking about, you know, in the Cambrian, this distinction between going from a, you know, very simple environment to one where you needed to be able to learn in unassociated ways over time so you could, you know, basically persist and replicate more effectively. And Walter Veit, another previous guest, talks about pathological complexity. Again, this stage where you go from, you know, very simple environment to one where you actually have to make more dynamic, more complex choices to be able to survive and replicate. And so I think there's something around those mechanisms that did lead to, you know, meaningful sentience quite early in the evolution of life that just wasn't there before and isn't there in animal objects. You know, I think there's a meaningful difference there, but it doesn't mean it's, you know, easy to pin down. It doesn't mean there's a magical boundary either. And you could, you know, you can take a similar stance in the developmental cycle of animals and humans as well. You know, the classic abortion debate, right? Is there some magical point where light comes down and sentience emerges? Well, no, I don't. But at the same time, there is a meaningful difference between, you know, whether a blastocyst is sentient and whether a newborn child is. So I think there's analogies in the sort of evolutionary life, you know, evolutionary scale and in the development scale, where this, whatever we call this consciousness and sentience, do seem to emerge.
There used to be this concept, I think this has been debunked, but ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, right? So the thought was that, you know, the fetus, so the embryos, the zygote embryo fetus goes through the same stages of evolution as the species did. And it was based on the fact that for a time, it looks a little bit like a fish or something, right? But even if it doesn't, right, there's a kind of isomorphism between the two processes.
Yeah, yeah, that's it, yeah, yeah. Well, that's fascinating. Thank you. So we've covered what's real, what matters, and who matters. And apologies for taking up so much of your time, but I could talk to you for hours. The final crazily big question, which is arguably as tough, is how can we make a better future, ideally for all the sentient beings? So I'd love your view on this question, both writ large. You know, do you have some sort of utopian vision for where we might be able to get to? But I'm also really interested in your views about the role of the law in driving positive change, whether it's about this sort of sentientist taking non-human animals more seriously, or actually in the intrahuman space, in the work you do as a constitutional lawyer, which is a fun topic in the past few years in the States.
Yeah.
So you can go wherever you like on this, crazily big question about how do we make a better future, but there's some themes in there that maybe we can dig into.
Right. So I'll start with a story I tell my students on the last day of class, because I think it's useful. It's a very old, originally Chinese, but also Korean folktale. And it's got an element of speciesism, which we'll have to overlook. So it's a very famous story in East Asian cultures. So an old man has a prized horse, and one day the horse runs away, and the man is he's crestfallen. He's very upset about this whole thing. He thinks this is a disaster. Some time passes, and the horse returns, accompanied by a second horse. And the old man is delighted because he thought he'd lost his horse, but not only does he have his horse, he has a second horse. Then one day, the old man's son, without asking the old man for permission, rides on the back of the new horse. And the new horse, of course, is not accustomed to having people ride on her, so she throws him off, and he badly fractures his leg in a way that leaves him permanently disabled. And the old man is heartbroken. But shortly after that, a war breaks out, and they draft into the military service all the able-bodied men of the area. And so the old man's son is not drafted because he's unable to perform military service. Everybody else who's drafted ends up being killed in the war, and so the man is happy. So I've forgotten what the word for this is in Chinese or Korean, but the basic lesson of it is to have a kind of equanimity about good and bad fortune, because you never know what appears to be good fortune could turn out to be bad, and vice versa. And I think that's true. But I think it also ought to give us a little bit of humility about trying to achieve good in the world, because there are invariably unforeseen consequences. And so what you try to do to produce good could produce bad. So I was delighted when Barack Obama became president. I knew him in law school. We actually took a seminar together. We worked together as research assistants. And I thought very highly of him. I still think very highly of him. His presidency was probably a but-for cause of Donald Trump's presidency. So was that a good thing or a bad thing? Who knows? And so I begin with a kind of humility about the possibility of doing good. I think that informs my own stance, which is that at the very least, sort of act locally, right? That means for me, it's most important to be kind and considerate of the people around me, people and an animal, of non-human animals around me. So that my children, my dogs, my colleagues, my friends, my neighbors, extended family members, right? So that seems simple. Moving outward, right? Most of my activism is done through two things. One is just writing and putting my ideas out there, and I don't know how effective any of that is. I think I probably persuade some people of some things, and others of others, and some people are not persuaded at all. Maybe that has an effect. But then I do actually, teach and do some work as a lawyer. And my view about the law is is that it is a limited but a sometimes effective tool. So, you know, if you think about its role in protecting non-human animals, I think at the where things currently are, it plays almost no role. In the US, the UK, the EU, you know, most places that have on the books laws that nominally protect animals do almost nothing. They're riddled with loopholes. They have very ineffective enforcement. They have, you know, exceptions so that, you know, rodents don't count as animals for purposes of experiment. So that, you know, and I think that's a reflection of the fact that, you know, law in constitutional democracies and even in authoritarian regimes, maybe more so in authoritarian regimes, are not going to be more than at most a sort of standard deviation away from public opinion. So I think that until, you know, so one has to work on public opinion. But I will say, and this is a point that I got from Sherry, who in turn got it from somebody else, I don't remember who else, but I think law plays a very important role in sort of creating the ecosystem in which activism can occur. So here's a very sort of straightforward example. California had a law that said you couldn't operate a commercial kitchen out of a home if you had an animal in your home. Now, what they meant was if you had a living animal, because of course you could have dead animals that you're creating food out. Yeah. So some animal-friendly lawyers work to try to change that law. That seems to me a very useful intervention. Another useful intervention: people want to protest in front of or do investigations of slaughterhouses, right? A bunch of U.S. states have what are conventionally known as ag gag laws. These are laws that forbid this sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. Lobbying to change those laws or bringing challenges that in this case bring together not just animal rights groups but free speech activists, free press activists, right, changes that, and then that can work on building public opinion. So I think that, you know, law is not entirely epiphenomenal on social attitudes, right? It can move things, but it's got to have a handhold. And so until you have broader social acceptance for something like sentientism, right, the most useful thing one can do as a lawyer is at least remove obstacles to effective advocacy.
Yeah, thank you. And the people I've spoken to who are involved in the legal space, it's interesting. I think there'd be much agreement with what you said. You can't be too far away from public opinion, but there are interesting instances where the law does at least gently go ahead and then can open up rapid changes in public opinion. So my understanding as an amateur is that you know, same-sex marriage has been one of those spaces, yeah, where in some countries the law was actually a little bit ahead of public opinion, but once it went into law, public opinion then rapidly shifted and the law sort of almost validated that this is an acceptable stance, and you know, and people came around. So it can play a leading role, but I guess maybe not going too far ahead. Yeah,
I think that's right. I mean, I've done some work with a political scientist at Cornell named Sid Tarrow, who writes extensively about social movements. We look specifically at same-sex marriage as an example of that, and that's clearly, you know, there was a kind of feedback effect where the law changed public attitudes, which in turn made it easier to change the law and so forth. So you can get these positive feedback loops. And I think eventually there's no reason why you couldn't do that for non-human animals.
Yeah, makes sense.
I will say there's one other thing I would say is that, you know, I think about the Non-Human Rights Project's work, which I've been a kind of skeptical supporter of. I'm certainly not going to oppose that work. And I've worked in support of some of their cases, one involving an elephant in the Bronx Zoo. Mm-hmm. And they lose every case, but sometimes you win by losing, right? That is to say, the goal isn't necessary, right? So it'd be great if you could, you know, have Happy the Elephant released from the Bronx Zoo into an elephant sanctuary. But short of that, at the very least, you're raising consciousness and building momentum for reforms when you bring these cases.
Yeah, I'm picking up some interesting dissenting opinions that maybe prefigure where we might be able to go. And the thing you said earlier on about the role of animal protection law at the moment globally, I sort of share the frustration with that, because on the one hand, you look at what happens with EU legislation around recognizing animal sentience and similar in the UK and others around the other place, and you go, well, that's amazing, isn't it? Sentience is being baked in, right? This is awesome. But in practice at the moment, it's really the analogy for the average human who says, I care about animals, but it's still fine to eat them, because there's a recognition of sentience in, you know, many non-human animal species. There's a recognition of the moral salience of sentience, but then almost a weird, insidious redefinition of the very words moral consideration and compassion to allow egregious, horrific harms. So do you see those types of things as being a, you know, positive stepping stone that will take us somewhere good, or are you more cynical and you see them as sort of dead ends of humans convincing ourselves that we can just carry on doing what we're doing and put some nice words in some ineffective laws?
Yeah, I think the jury is out. So in the book that Sherry and I wrote together on abortion and animal rights, we have a chapter on meliorism. And it's very hard to generalize. So, right, the conventional wisdom, there's this story, right, Trotsky never tipped, right, because he thought that, you know, it would delay the revolution. I don't know whether that's true or not. So sometimes the adoption of baby steps cuts off reform, and, you know, it allows people to feel good about what they're doing, and that's the end of it. But sometimes it's a stepping stone, right? Yeah. So again, right before there was same-sex marriage, there were civil unions, domestic partnerships that could have killed the movement, but in fact it sort of accelerated because people came to realize, well, there's no reason to stop there. And I think it's very hard to know ex ante.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah. So let me force you into some deeply utopian thinking now, just as we finish up. I will let you go in a minute. So I've just done a couple of amateur thought experiments of thinking through everything from individual personal actions all the way through local politics, through national politics, through even to international global governance. And just as a thought experiment, imagined what some of those policies and institutions might look like if we had a completely sentientist worldview. So as one example, I've rewritten the top level of the sustainable development goals as sentientist development goals and said, look, if we really thought about sustainability from a sentientist perspective, not just a human perspective, what might that look like? And another one I did was to rewrite slightly cheekily the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a Universal Declaration of Sentient Rights. And in both cases, I actually found it much easier than I thought it would, because of our common evolutionary history and because humans are animals too, the most important needs, interests that we have are the most fundamentally shared across non-human animals. So, of course, you can talk about whether, you know, a chicken really needs a right to education, for example. Fine, we can debate that. But when you're talking about sustenance, survival, harm, you know, social environment, compassion, shelter, you know, the basic stuff, there's so much in common. So can you imagine a future where, for example, to bind together two of your areas of interest, there is a future United States Constitution that talks about a sentientist worldview that accords moral consideration to all sentient beings, not just humans? Can you imagine what that document might look like? And do you think we'll ever get there?
Yeah. So let me refer to two sets of writings about this, which I think are useful for informing it. So one is Martha Nussbaum's idea of the capacities approach, which, so I like Martha very much. I think she's, you know, a very interesting thinker. I disagree with her implementation of it. She's not a vegan. She has, I think, very limited understanding of what animal capacities really are. But yes, I think in principle the approach makes a lot of sense. The closest thing I know in the literature to what you're describing is the book by Will Kimlicka and Sue Donaldson, Zoopolis, which imagines, which sort of divides non-human animals among free-living animals who are treated sort of like, you know, sovereigns, Then I think denizens, which are the animals that sort of live among us, like, you know, rats and pigeons and so forth, but are not really part of us. And then citizens, dogs, cats, they have in mind domesticated animals that are currently used for food products like cows and sheep. I don't agree with everything that they say in that book. I think they allow for exploitation in ways that I wouldn't approve. But I do think there's one insight they have that I think is quite useful, which is that I think that if one thinks in these terms, I think there's a tendency to want to think of non-human animals as what philosophers call moral patients, right? That is to say, the bearers of rights but not duties. And it's better to be a moral patient than to have no moral consideration at all. But there's still something dignified about being a moral actor and not just a moral patient. And so I would want this sort of, you know, constitution for the sentient beings to, at a minimum, recognize the rights of non-human animals as moral patients, but also, and I haven't sort of worked all of this out, to have some recognition for their agency.
Yeah. Fascinating. And I think another work that I think complements Oopolis but takes a different approach is Alistair Cochrane's Sentientist Politics, which I think plays into that story much more. It actually thinks about non-human animals as agents and even particularly participants in our democracy and our institutions in a more active way. So maybe we'll get there. So what year do you think the US Constitution will be amended to reflect your draft?
So it's funny, you know, I remember being at a conference in the early 2000s. This was a constitutional law conference. And, you know, after the official panels were over, a group of us were sort of having drinks at the bar. And this is all a group of, you know, political liberals. And somebody said, how far away do you think same-sex marriage throughout the country is? And none of the possible answers were even close to how soon it occurred. And so, you know, my optimistic side says, well, maybe it's sooner than I think, you know, that is, you know, right. And, you know, the real question is, right, does the planet survive long enough to get us there? So,
yeah, exactly. One of my previous guests said, you know, I'm long-term optimistic about the future, but we just need to get there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's an inspiring, hopeful note to finish on. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Mike. What's the best way of people following you, reading Dorf on Law, keeping up to date with your social media? I'll put the links in the show notes, of course, so don't worry, but where would you mainly point
people? So the first place I'd say is go to my blog, dorfonlaw.org. I blast out each blog post. There's a Facebook fans group. There is, for now at least, still a Twitter account at Dorf on Law. I don't know how much longer I'll keep that up.
Until Elon bans you.
Yes, right. I've signed up for, but I'm still on the waiting list for Post, which is apparently supposed to be a good alternative. Haven't yet tried out Mastodon. But if you just go to the blog itself, you can subscribe by email and you just get those automatically. So there, and I also write roughly every 2 weeks on Verdict, which is verdict.justia.com.
That's brilliant. Well, thank you. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Mike.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
A real honor. And please stay in touch. Thank you for joining Sentientist Conversations.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?